For 50 years, NAIDOC Week has honoured and elevated the voices of First Nations communities, grounded in culture and strong in identity. This NAIDOC Week, celebrate Black excellence with programs like Away, Speaking Out and Word Up. As we mark 50 years of Deadly, this week and every week, right here on ABC Radio National.
Hello and welcome to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. I'm Cassie McCullough.
And I'm Kate Evans, and this is where every week we scan the long, long lists of new books and select those that we think are worth talking about. And we do that, of course, with a selection of reviewers as well.
Today, Mysterious Sounds and Uncanny Desires on a remote Tasmanian island in Chris Neen's Rite of Spring.
And family stories and politics laid bare in Morocco and France in Leila Slimani's I'll Take the Fire.
And also, I managed to catch up with Bruce Pascoe recently, the writer and farmer, and I asked him about some of his favourite Australian books, and we'll hear that later on.
Oh, well, I'm looking forward to hearing that one, Cassie. To begin, though, we'll spend a week in Melbourne and another in Wellington in the latest novel from Laura McPhee Brown. It's called Worry Doll.
Now, Laura McPhee Brown is an Australian novelist and short story writer. She's also an essayist and a counsellor. And her debut novel, Cherry Beach, was published in 2020.
We also, here on the bookshelf, read her second novel, Little Plum. That came out in 2023, and it was a story of a woman named Coral who was pregnant with her own little plum. It was a story about change and transformation, as well as anxiety, and I remember it was full of semi-precious stones.
Yeah, everyone was called, like, sort of ruby and, I don't know, topaz or something. I can't remember.
Probably not Beryl. I think that's a semi-precious stone name that's gone out of fashion. Call out to my own Auntie Beryl there, of course.
Hi, Auntie Beryl. But yes, let's turn to this new one, Worry Doll. And let's start with the structure, which you only find out after you read it, of course. But it's a story in two halves. So the first half is through the eyes of a woman called Heloise. So Heloise is in her late 30s. She and her partner, Ernesto, have been together for 8 years. Ernesto is a great name, but it only gets one mention, I think, and then he's Ernie after that, which is a very different very different name. They have a cat.
We hear a lot about that cat. The cat's called Pearl.
Yeah, and she works in a women's refuge where women who are escaping violence or have had some traumatic incident or living with a mental condition live in quite a peaceful, cooperative environment where they have their own rooms and share other facilities like kitchens and laundries and you know, the living room.
But it takes us a while to find out about her working life, and it's a bit hard to, well, I found it a bit hard to ground her as a character at the beginning, because what we hear about is that she's got very cool hair with a particular, you know, fringe and side parting, and she lives in a sort of cool inner city Melbourne, where she meets up with her friends and they go to the right cafes and lives in this sort of funky little house.
Mm, I didn't see her as cool. I mean, that fringe that she has, she cut with some toenail scissors herself in front of the mirror, which is, I guess, a kind of cool sort of Melbourne punk, I suppose. But I thought she was a little insecure and on the outer, but relying on Ernesto, as I insist on calling him, as her rock, something that kept her grounded in the real world.
Yes, and I agree with that take on her as well, but we sort of see it with things like them meeting up with another couple, and she can't quite relax into the experience. It's almost adversarial. It's almost like she's got an arch relationship to these other women, and she says something like, she wished she wasn't insecure by seeing other people's happy relationship, and yet she is. So we're sort of even not quite sure about the status of her relationship with the adoring Ernesto / Ernie.
He is of Filipino descent and has a lovely family who's very welcoming and generous and quite loving towards Heloise. But what we learn soon enough about her is that she does not have a mother. She has a very distant father who is a presence, but not one on a daily level. But what we find out is that soon after Heloise was born, she died. Now, initially, we think she died as part of the childbirth process, but later we find it something else. So this is possibly the source of Heloise's imprisonment in her own mind, her rumination, her psychological blueprint that seems to have been with her for life.
Well, the other thing that we learn about her actually on the first page of the novel is that she's having an affair. And so this sense that she is caught up in secrets and that this is very important to her. At another point very early on, she's listening to a podcast about secrets and she reflects it had been scary to hear herself spoken about by people who didn't even know she would be listening. Heloise keeps secrets and the secrets weigh her down, but they also help. So, you know, she's always distracted by her phone. She's always waiting to hear that a text might have come in from this woman who she met and snogged on a train and who she's sort of obsessed
snogged,
with.
Snogged, Kate? Oh, this is the bookshelf on Radio National.
Who she kissed passionately on a train, jolted into on a train. And it's sort of thrilling. It thrilled her, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. And she has endless erotic fantasies about meeting up with Lacey, who is at least 15 years her junior. So Lacey's 24. She's kind of a tomboy, if we're still allowed to use that word, like she's a tradie type. And Heloise is in her mid-30s and, well, she's desperately attracted to Lacey, and she has endless sort of erotic fantasies. She's really fallen hard.
And this is a woman who she's longing for, who she's desiring, but who she's forever waiting for. And so, as we said, Heloise's story is just set over a week, so it's divided into the days, and she's always waiting, when's she going to hear from Lacey, when's she going to see her, what's happening next? And we're not clear when this woman is going to appear and what's going to happen between them. And meanwhile, she's sort of a bit untethered from the world. She keeps on losing things and losing track of things, and you wonder what that means.
Hmm. So we start to sense that perhaps we have an unreliable narrator on our hands, that we're not really anchored in reality, although there's plenty to suggest that she's going on with her life and she just has this fantasy life where she indulges her inner desires and fears. And clearly the loss of the mother is the key story for her, the mother wound that she's suffering. But what we can say about this book is she's got a beautiful turn of phrase, Laura McPhee Brown. Let me just read a paragraph here. This is when they're getting ready to go to dinner at Ernesto's family house. It is a hot night, the sky is prematurely dark and murky, full of clouds like smoke. The suburb Ernie's parents live in is all hills and bends, front yards full of flowers and abandoned toys. They park on a steep patch, and Ernie places a brick he keeps in the car behind a back wheel to make a wish that the car will not roll. The air outside is still and close. In the distance, Heloise can hear a house party. It's just a passing paragraph, but gee, it sets that scene, that mood, that suburban peace beautifully.
And there's something about reading details like that that draws you into the story, and even the warmth of Ernie's family, who are, you know, really lovely characters. And then there are these little moments that sort of strike a peculiar note that take you outside of the scene as well. So in that one, they'd brought along ice cream for dessert and she's lost it. Like the fact that she keeps losing track of things.
Had she brought it? Did Ernesto even know there was ice cream?
Well, we're not sure, and that's part of what you're saying about the our relationship to this narrator, because at times I found myself getting exasperated by her. And then I thought, of course, reading isn't necessarily about likability or feeling that, you know, you're sharing the experience with the narrator. But it really put me in a sort of point of tension with her, trying to make work out what I made of her as the voice of the book.
Mm. So I don't know that we need to say too much more about the second half of this book, because it really is impossible to talk about it without spoiling the essence of it and the surprises.
But I think what we can say, Cassie, is that we're then meeting another character across another week, and that character is Lacey, the woman who Heloise has been longing for. And so we get a different perspective on the world, even a different sort of style of writing and energy. I actually quite liked the energy in the second half of the book when we're taking into another place and another woman's perspective and desires and dreams and crises.
Yes, and it's quite dramatic, and you have to decide how much of what you're reading is real and just how and who is the most unhinged.
Yeah, it becomes uneasy, almost a sort of psychological thriller, and we can't really say how, but it's one of those things that makes you not just read into the moment of the second half of the book, but to reread your sense of what you've read before. And that I found quite clever, because it sort of undid a whole series of my own expectations from the first half of the book.
Yeah, it's an interesting experiment, I think, and an unusual structure for a novel.
Yeah, that structure crept up on me. I was questioning it at some point, and then I thought, oh, I know why she's doing this. This has been carefully considered.
But don't come to this book for answers.
Oh, no, don't do that.
It's called Worry Doll, and it's by Laura McPhee Brown. Well, here on ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, it's time to say g'day to our reviewers, crime writer Michael Robotham and writer and teacher Rowan Ungol-Salvez. Hello to you both.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you, Cassie.
Hi, Cassie. Hi, Kate.
Hello, hello. Well, look, let's get straight into the books that you've read for us, beginning with the latest novel from the French-Moroccan journalist and writer Leila Slimani.
Well, she's not just a writer, is she? She sort of has this cultural diplomacy role, semi-officially, with French President Emmanuel Macron. She's also won literary awards in France for her fiction, which includes Lullaby, which we read here on the bookshelf, and Adele and Watch Us Dance.
And she's also written books of non-fiction, apart from her journalism, including a study of sex in Morocco.
Okay, so her latest novel is out. It's called I'll Take the Fire. Where does it fit with her other work, Kate?
Well, look, I read this one as a standalone novel, and it does work as such, I think. But it's actually the third in a series known as The Country of Others, which is based in part on her own family history. And what that means, though, is that the dramatis personae at the very front of the book is really useful, because it gives us a sort of potted history of the main character's family. But at the heart of it is a woman named Mia, born in Rabat in 1974. Her grandmother was French, her grandfather was Moroccan, and her parents are both middle-class Moroccans, with her father a financier and her mother a doctor. And we come to know most of these people and other members of the family so intimately, so beautifully, Michael. But it's this character, Mia, who is the sort of filter through which the whole story is told.
Yeah, it's. I thought it read as a memoir. I mean, it's, and I know it very closely mirrors the life of the author, who the Mia character is probably about 8 years, born about 8 years earlier. But so much of what happened mirrors the life of Leila Slimani, the author.
Did you have to keep checking back on that overview, though, of the family at the front? Because I did.
I think that, yeah, that becomes really important, because you lose track of who the grandparents are and who the sister is and the aunts, because it is a large cast of characters. I gave the book to my wife and I said straight away, take careful note of those opening pages where you're introduced to all the characters, because you will be going back trying to remember who they are. But I think as a memoir or as a novel, it works incredibly well. It's a beautiful story told across 40 years, which has got tragedy and it's got pathos and it's got enormous empathy, and it's beautifully written.
So Mia is the central character. How do we meet her?
Well, we meet her with this quite intriguing prologue set in 2021. She's in crisis in this period. She's living in France as a writer. She's having all these health dramas. She ends up seeing a neurologist, and one of the things she says to him is, look, I'm worried I'm losing my memories. And he says, you never lose your memories. They're just there sort of hidden, and you have to work out how to excavate them. And he says to her, you have to find your Madeleine. You have to, you know, like Proust, you have to find those moments. And it's
just explain that for people who haven't read.
I had to look that up straight away. It's a very famous sort of idea that a smell or a sound or a taste can bring you back into childhood more instantaneously than probably anything else. That's your Madeleine.
There's these sweet little cakes.
Yes, and she had to find what would take her back into her family history and bring her memories back.
So there's a reference that it's only very short. It's only 4 or 5 pages, this prologue, but it sort of helps set up the whole rest of the book as being filtered through this character's experience. Because even though you say, Michael, you can read it as a memoir, it's not a first-person novel. We actually meet all of these different characters in a sort of close third person. So as we then go back into her history, how do we then meet Mia from another perspective?
Well, we meet Mia initially as a child waiting for her sister to be born. There's a wonderful line very early on that, she hates the idea of getting a sister. She wants to crawl into her mother's womb and to kick the baby out.
Oh, God.
And she also is desperate to be her father's son, because Mia, as you discover watching her grow up and discover her sexuality, is not a typical, you know, her sister, Ines, is a beautiful little girl and a traditional little girl who loves her dresses and pretty things. Mia is not like that at all. And Mia wants to be a boy. And Mia ultimately, as we see her grow up into teenagehood and fall in love for the first time with a girl, you know, in a country like Morocco, and we have to keep framing this against the backdrop. We are talking about these people growing up in Morocco, a deeply conservative country where homosexuality is illegal. It's a horrible coming-of-age story, really, watching her go through that.
We keep being reminded of what version of Morocco we're entering into. These are middle-class Moroccans. Their father, Mehdi, who we also meet very early on in 1980, is the first time we sort of enter into his life story. He's just taken over a bank, a sort of financial institution in Casablanca, and he's really determined to make it a success, to bring in computers, to make sure there's no corruption. And so that sort of wars against a lot of the external images of Morocco, where Mia herself says people want a story of tragedy and poverty and, you know, overcoming the slums. And that's not her experience. You know, her mother is a gynecologist, her father is a financier.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, to me, this very much is a novel of the clash of cultures. They are Francophile Moroccans. They are more French than Moroccan. They go to the most exclusive schools where their students are delivered by chauffeurs, you know, and occasionally through the window they'll glimpse barefoot children who aren't going to school at all, and they'll get a glimpse of the poverty in Morocco. But they themselves are, I wouldn't even say middle class, they are very much upper class.
They're also living in a world of fear and politics. So there's a lot of the book is also about things that are hidden, things that aren't said, lives that are being led sort of just below the surface. So these are Moroccans who will drink alcohol, people will have affairs, they will critique the system. And of course, this waxes and wanes as something you can and can't do, depending on what's happening across this 40 years of Moroccan history.
And I think that's one of the beautiful things about the book is it is set against this big backdrop of you have the Arab Spring and you have the Berlin Wall coming down and you have 9/11 and you have all these major events which change the nature of Morocco and change their own situation. There's a moment in the book where Mia discovers, really, as all children do, what hypocrites her parents are, because her parents have raised her in a very progressive household and told, you know, them as even as girls, they can speak their mind and they should be educated and all of that. But she talks about, you know, at home it was fine to criticize the veil to vent your anger against the horrible bearded men who were threatening Salman Rushdie, but in the outside world you must not talk, must not be provocative, must pretend to respect the rules of decorum, which included never talking about the king or rigged elections. Her parents were hypocrites, and Mia felt humiliated when she realised they were not free.
Mm-hmm. But does she become as hypocritical as her parents?
Well, she leaves the country and goes to study overseas when she's 17. So we also see her living in Paris and trying to find a new way of living. But what she does, because we meet her on those first pages as a depressed writer, and so we think we're going to see the story of a novelist, but she studies business and she works in banking and in the whole world of money. And then her younger sister studies medicine, as their mother was also a doctor. So they're sort of moving in and out of different spheres all the time. But of course, because it is a coming of age story, we see her criticism of her parents, but then we get these intimate sections about her parents' lives, which are sort of tender and beautifully done. I mean, particularly her mother is literally looking inside women, inside their bodies as a gynecologist. And she's somebody who's happy to, you know, go against the sort of rules of her society and look after women who can't pay, look after the poor, look after prostitutes. And I found the portrait of the mother, Aisha, just fascinating.
I did. And I thought the portrait of the father, because Mehdi, he is an honourable man. He set about as a banker. He wants to drag Morocco into the first world. He wants it to make as rich and prosperous as France. And but, you know, and this is what mirrors the author's own experience with her own father, is ultimately he rises too high, he becomes too powerful, and he gets charged with corruption. It's a terrible fall from grace for this man who doesn't flee Morocco when he has the opportunity, when they're begging him to flee. He's saying, no, I trust the judicial system. I trust this country. You know, I'm an honourable man. You know, I will be exonerated.
She's angry, isn't she?
Oh, it's an angry book, I think. The author is angry about the way her father was treated, and then that is portrayed in the way, you know, she has Mehdi being treated. Because ultimately, you only have to read about the author to know that her father was only fully exonerated after he was dead, you know, and she's angry about that because he tried to do so much for the country.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I found fascinating about this book was the way that the writing itself shifted depending on whose perspective we were close to. And there are two sections in the book that focus on the mother that are written almost in a stream of consciousness section, 6 or 7 pages with no paragraph breaks, getting that sort of frantic sense of this woman who's trying to hold it all together. And I found those shifts in writing style really powerful. How did that work for you, Michael?
I agree. I could have heard from the mother for an entire novel. I mean, her story as a gynecologist in a country like Morocco was fascinating in itself, you know. But I think ultimately it's that book about people being trapped between cultures. Ultimately, are they French or are they Moroccan? And I think they were probably more French than Moroccan, but that was what Mia had to overcome. And I think, you know, even at the very end of the book, she says, you know, when people ask me where I'm from, I never know what to say. I become like a stutterer, unable to get the word out, and finally exhausted, give up trying. My father, the great pretender, liked to make out he was something he wasn't. And like him, I have become my own counterfeiter, a poor copy of a masterpiece, a forged banknote that is worthless to all but the most gullible of fools, those who deserve to be ripped off. She's a lovely writer.
Mm. So this is actually translated from the French. How's the translation?
Oh, beautiful. And you don't even think about it as a translation until those moments when you see a little asterisk in the text and we get a note about a particular Arabic word or a term in French that makes you think about language and what it means. And it's done with quite a graceful touch.
This is an example of why when books win major awards in translation, in this case the translator was Sam Taylor, who I don't know, but Sam Taylor, take a bow, remarkable.
That's Leila Slimani's I'll Take the Fire, which was translated from the French by Sam Taylor. This is ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, on air, on ABC Listen, on your favourite podcast delivery service. And each week we bring you books from Australia, around the world, and hopefully give you something to remember next time you're walking past a library or bookshop. I'm Cassie McCullough, here with Kate Evans, and our reviewers today, Michael Robotham and Roanna Gonsalves.
And from Morocco and France, we're returning now to Australia, to Tasmania in particular, with the latest from novelist, poet and memoirist Chris Neen.
Now, Chris Neen's books include the memoirs The Three Burials of Lottie Neen and Fat Girl Dancing, and also a poetry collection, Eating My Grandmother, and the novels Steeplechase and Uncertain Grace and Wintering. So this, the latest, seventh novel, is called Rite of Spring. And I understand this book is on an island, which must be the location of the year. We have, I think it's four books already, halfway through the year, we've had on islands.
We've had Michael Pedersen's Muckleflugger, Douglas Stewart's John of John, Jonathan Miles' Eradication, which had feral goats on an island. And then late last year, there was Garrett Carr's The Boy from the Sea, Charlotte McConaughey's Wild Dark Shore. So islands everywhere. And this one, it's set on a windswept remote island off the coast of Tasmania. It has a lighthouse that's now automated, but it's now a weather station, a research island, and a woman named Miranda, who's a marine scientist, and her husband Richard are heading there as this story opens. So who are these people, Roanna, and why are they off to this island?
It's a story set on an island, off an island, off an island in that sense. It's so remote. The setting is compellingly...
Oh, you mean like it's Tasmania, which is off Australia, and an island off Tasmania. Right.
So Miranda is a marine biologist who has had an accident where she nearly drowned. And she's trying to recover from this. Her husband, Richard, likes fixing things. But he has broken his own marriage by having an affair. Dun-dun. And he is now trying to put the pieces back together. They see an ad for caretakers to be on this weather station off Tasmania on this little island. And they sign up, hoping that it will kind of bring them together, repair their relationship in some way, find themselves in some way.
Excuse me for giggling, but yes, it's one hell of a life choice.
Yes, it's supposed to be for 6 months. I don't want to give away the ending, obviously, but it is this very compelling novel that kind of braids the dangerous and the erotic and the transformative in the most compelling, beautiful way.
And I understand there was a real ad for a 6-month residency on a remote island that Chris Neen saw, and both thought, oh my goodness, who would do that? But also, what a great fictional setting. What could possibly go wrong? Well, sort of everything. And although this is a story, Roanna, about this windy, dramatic island, steep, difficult paths, plenty of birds, beautifully, really beautifully described natural world, it's the sea that defines Miranda, though, isn't it?
Yeah, very much. It's very much the sea. Jen Webb, in a review in The Conversation, reviewing this book, talks about this relationship between humans and what we used to be, creatures of the sea. And she quotes a scholar who says, we carry the ocean with us in our bodies. And that's very much a central theme of this book, that we are made of water and we are, or the main character, Miranda, very much feels like she or they are very much water is their element. They are in their element in water, and water is their element. So that's very much a central theme.
But it has been disrupted. So this is a woman whose working life had been as a marine biologist. She felt most comfortable in the sea. She sort of feels uncomfortable in her body, and it's a body that's changing. She's at menopause, and she feels like her waist is thickening, her skin is changing, and that she's sort of slightly lumbered down by the air and by gravity. So she longs for this water, but a doctor has said to her, you can't get under the sea, you shouldn't put your head under, it's too dangerous for you to dive. So, you know, this is a woman in crisis in relation to the sea, isn't she?
Yeah, she's very much in crisis, physically in crisis, because she is almost forbidden to do the thing that she loves, which is wanting to go down and dive into the ocean. But she's also in crisis in terms of she's at that point where she's at the end of reproductive life. And yet it's this moment where she's coming into the prime of her erotic life. The whole novel is very much right from the start about, okay, I don't want to give away the ending, but it's moving towards something rich and strange, which is, you know, I'm quoting from The Tempest, which is what this book is actually riffing off. Jen Webb talks about this again in her review.
I want to know, I'm sorry, but you sort of haven't mentioned the couple in terms of, you know, the man. I mean, he's had an affair. They're together. I mean, how do they not kill each other on this island? I mean, is this relationship repaired before they get there, or are we seeing a marriage in crisis?
Well, I think they've decided to go on this six-month kind of adventure in order to see if they can breach that. She describes it as a thin layer of a strip of sand between them. And so there's very much the intention. They're both aware that the marriage, the relationship is in crisis, but he has nursed her back to health. So there's that sense of being indebted. There's real love between them, love and care between them. And so it's very much about trying to bridge this gap that has opened up. But that gap is also really kind of braided with all of this sense of indebtedness, the sense of love, the sense of care.
And well, that they operate in the world in different ways. I mean, in a sort of Shakespearean sense, he's a practical person. He knows how to fix things. He's very much of the earth. And she's drawn to this, you know, moving fluid world and to watching the seals and to being aware of caverns at the end of the ocean. But, you know, as Rowena said, it becomes strange, and it's something that Christine is very good at in their writing, which is drawing attention to the strange and making us think about the world in a slightly different way.
Is it magic realism?
Well, it's been described as Australian Gothic, okay. And it's kind of like the sense of haunting, the sense of describing with precision the monstrous, horrific aspects of nature, but braided and entwined with the horror of it is also beauty and strangeness and excitement and eroticism and lust.
And the uncanny. And some of that is being done because there had been other people. I mean, there have been years and years of people working as caretakers on this island, which means they have left their notes and their journals behind, because a number of times a day they have to go out to the weather station and measure things. But also, Miranda then realises that there are creatures that have been carved into the trees, and these sort of scarecrows that have been made. And at first she sort of jumps and thinks there's a person, and then goes, oh no, it's this creature that's been made and it seems beautiful. And then she gets closer and there's sort of teeth and claws. So it's something very uncanny going on. That's our sort of first sense that there's something odd on this island. And then she hears a sound, and it's like a keening. So it's almost like whale sound, but it hits her body. So to her, it's the sound of lust and desire. And she's really aware of this sense that there's something else there. And then she sees somebody, or she sees something on the island. And that sort of sets things running. Is there somebody there? Has she imagined it? Is Richard going to see this as well?
Okay, so is it a siren? Is it a sort of mythological
thing?
It's
a creature of the island. It's a creature of the sea. It's a creature of the island. It's a creature of that place.
A sexy merman.
It's kind of very much linked to, because at the start she thinks she's dreaming it. And she tells Richard about it, and Richard, of course, gaslights her and says, no, darling, you know, you have had this accident. You're making up things.
Oh,
your mind is playing tricks.
Is it his alter ego? See, I'm just going to start guessing.
No, it's not. I mean, you've got to read the book. It's just this stunning, really beautiful and quite uncanny, as you said, Kate, and quite embodied sense of the horror and the beauty of the natural world around us.
And of the erotic.
So
slightly strange sex, monsters and sex, all of that and more.
Yes, and more.
Is stuff that Christine is very interested in and explores more and more as the novel goes on.
Yes.
And it's beautifully, beautifully done. And your sense of what's real and what's not real, what's monstrous and horrifying, or what's beautiful and compelling and attractive shifts as the novel goes on, which is part of like things and bodies are being transformed all yes. throughout this book.
Yes. There's a sense of movement towards acceptance and a movement towards loving the self in a way that one has not loved oneself before. And the narrator in the book says something quite beautiful at one point, which to me is kind of like the nub of the book, which is angels and devils are made the same way. So it's very much this rejection of binaries, sexual gender binaries, but also binaries between good and evil. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's not about, you know, oh, you've had an affair and we have to kill each other. But it's a much more complex, sophisticated understanding of this rejection of black and white and exploring the complexity and the nuance of the in-between.
It's also a novel that pulls on all sorts of different literary traditions about angels and demons and monsters and things falling off the edge of the world. And some of that is done through the journals of KJ, the mysterious woman who has made these effigies and left them all over the island. So there's a sense that all these different traditions are coming together in this wild place.
So it sounds like it's a sort of mystical location where elements from other worlds or other knowledges exist. Is there a sense of this being an indigenous presence in the story?
Yeah, great question. I think very much so. This creature that becomes an important part of the story is a creature of the island and a creature of the waters around the island. And the narrator gestures towards indigenous knowledges. And I absolutely feel that the description of the landscape, the description of the body in connection with the landscape is very much influenced by First Nations writers.
And I guess the thing that Christine does as a writer is push those elements in a sort of sexual and erotic way while also writing about nature and landscape so beautifully.
That's Chris Neen's Rite of Spring. Okay, well, we've had some pretty saucy books today on the bookshelf. Let's see what else we can titillate ourselves with. Michael Rowbotham, have you got a book that you'd like to recommend us?
Oh, look, I know that Ann Patchett doesn't need any recommendation. I'm a big fan, but Whistler, her latest, which I listened to as an audiobook, which she narrated beautifully herself, is a book that I just wanted to wrap myself around like a winter coat and snuggle up in and just thought it was one of a remarkable story. It is a story of a middle-aged woman who meets her ex-stepfather 40 years after the divorce. Her mother divorced this man.
Yes, we were hearing about this on the bookshelf a couple of weeks ago. She's in a art gallery.
Yes.
And she sees this man looking at her and he sort of follows her around a bit and then she has this...
Yeah, her husband actually initially says, that man's following you, and she just dismisses it as to say, well, older men have always fancied me. Her husband happens to be 17 years older than her, so that was sort of,
bit of an in-joke.
The evidence. But it turned out to be this man that she hasn't seen in over 40 years. He was only stepfather for 2 years when she was like between the ages of about 7 and 9, but they were two of the most important years of her life, and it's the story of what happened and why he stopped being her stepfather. And
a man with the key to the past.
It's just such a beautifully told story.
So is it one of your favourites? It sounds like you really liked this one.
I did. It's funny. I thought I'll Take the Fire, the one that we've just reviewed, was one of my books of the year. But Whistler, I'm on a run at the moment. Whistler, I think, is one of my favourite books of the year also. And I'll give a quick shout out to someone that we mentioned earlier in this year. We mentioned Tana French and one of her series, her trilogy, the Cal Hooper series. I've just I've read another one called The Hunter, about a Chicago detective who retires to a small country town in Ireland full of wonderfully eccentric characters. And it is just a wonderfully gentle, crime novel where you fall in love with the characters, not about shoot 'em up and car chases or anything like that, but it's just beautiful characterization and consummate storytelling. So Tana French and The Hunter.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a crime writer yourself, that's a very high recommendation. What about you, Rowena?
Can I talk about books that I haven't read yet, but I'm looking forward to reading?
Go on. Future.
I'm looking forward to reading Gitanjali Shree's book, Tomb of Sand. Gitanjali Shree is a writer from India who writes in the Hindi language, and her book won the International Booker Prize a couple of years ago. She's coming to Sydney, and I'm really looking forward to reading the book before she gets here.
I've already had people talking to me about that one. I've added to my own TBR list.
So what's it about?
The story is about an 80-year-old woman who slips into depression. She is living with depression, and it's about what happens after that.
And if you forget any of these or you don't have the back of an envelope to scribble the details down on, never fear, because we put all of the details in our show notes if you're listening to the podcast version, and you can always go online and just find the bookshelf at ABC Radio National. Michael and Rowena, thank you so much for joining us again.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Great to have you, Kate. Thank you, Cassie.
Michael Rowbotham, internationally acclaimed crime writer whose books include The Secret She Keeps, When You Are Mine, and The White Crow. His next book, which is his first to be set in Australia, Tell Me Something True, will be released at the end of September. And Rowena Gonsalves is a writer and teacher and editor of the literary journal Southerly. Her short story collection is The Permanent Resident, and her novel The Servants will be out early next year.
This is ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf, on air and via podcast. And now to the latest on the upcoming ABC Radio National's Top 100 Australian Books Countdown, which is being held later this year in October. And this time we're hoping to find the nation's favourite Australian books of all time.
Yeah, so there were heaps of Australian books in last year's countdown. The theme of that one was Best Book of the 21st Century, so international books were all over it as well. But this one is entirely Australian. So I thought I might turn, Kate, to some Australian readers, writers for inspiration and ask them what books they consider among their favourites. It's a really hard job. It's a very difficult thing to nominate.
It's so hard, and it's great to have other people's perspective on it. I mean, partly they'll remind you of books that you might have read and had forgotten about, or things that you'd always meant to turn to. And then there's just that great thing about hearing about books that you didn't know anything about.
Yeah, you go, oh, right, that one sounds like it could be good. So in this spirit, we're planning to catch up with writers and ask them to nominate. So I started off this week with Bruce Pascoe, who is an Aboriginal writer and farmer who lives on Yuin country, best known, of course, for the best-selling non-fiction book Dark Emu. But he's also a writer of literary fiction, poetry, essays and children's literature.
Yes, he's just had a new poetry collection out in May called No Hiding from the Woman in the Moon, which is, among other things, a celebration of the moon, of life and of love.
Yes. So I asked him to nominate three Australian books he loves, and without hesitation, he chose Benang as his top pick, the 1999 novel by Kim Scott, the Indigenous Australian author. And he also nominated two more books, Marie Mankara's Every Secret Thing and Melissa Lukashenko's Mullumbimby. Let's hear it.
I don't know whether Benang is one of my favourite books or whether it just gave me such a jolt when I read it that I've never forgotten it, mainly because of the way it interprets the colonial record and investigates it from a black point of view. It was such a shock to see that in Australian fiction.
Tell us about the man Harley in this book.
It affected me deeply because there are so many Harleys in the Aboriginal community. And this kind of character, up until this point, hasn't been represented in Australian literature very much. So you've got a person investigating himself and what has happened to him and why it's happened. So you've got this very raw investigation going on, and this really unusual literary search. When I say literary, I mean you don't see it often in literature, or you haven't seen it very frequently in Australia. And so for me, the realisation that this was now mainstream had a deep impact on me. I'm a novelist myself, and I had written two or three books where I had investigated the colonial record as well. But Kim Scott is a different fish. He's a great writer, and his mind bends itself in really unusual directions. And the gift of his literature means that it's arresting.
This book is partly autobiographical. Parts of the central character's story overlap with Kim's. What happens in this book?
Well, it's trying to find out what actually happened, not just to the main character, but also to the family, and how it could happen. Some of the things are so crude and so cruel that you can't imagine anyone contriving to do such a thing, but they did. And it's a reflection of Australia, and that's why I was so drawn to it, because I thought my fellow Australians are going to read this and they're going to perhaps learn things about themselves and their country they didn't know before. So it had a real impact on me.
It changed the conversation, because this character is a white-skinned Aboriginal man. And for a long time...
Poor bastard. Yeah.
Well, for a long time, that's been a very difficult concept for much of Australia to understand. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, well, obviously that part of it was ringing deep bells within me, because, you know, I'm a pale-skinned Aboriginal man, and the way the hero is treated by non-Aboriginal society within the book is very, very close to the bone. And like I said before, that realisation that this is what our country has been like is galvanising, I think, for Australians who think about things like justice and hope. So that's why it was so important to me. You know, it was, you know, close to my bone, but very close to Kim's bone as well, and close to Australia's heart, should we ever investigate that organ.
Part of that story is about a man called A.O. Neville, who was, quote, chief protector of Aborigines and commissioner of native affairs in Western Australia. He was a British Australian public servant. People who saw Rabbit Proof Fence, the movie, he was played by Kenneth Branagh in that. It was a deliberate process that was being overseen by A.O. Neville to, again, quote, breed out the colour in the Indigenous populations. As a historian yourself, can you put that in context for us?
Well, there's A.O. Neville's right through Australia's history, but he was a particularly obnoxious person. With the kind of radical zeal that the best sadists have. And he seemed to really enjoy the pain inflicted by his policies, and he seemed to go out of his way to reorganise those policies to inflict even greater harm. You know, to think of him as a sadist is probably not far from the truth, but he's replicated in every state right through history. You know, Victoria had a fellow called Smythe who pretended to be the friend of Aboriginal people, but did things which destroyed community deliberately. And, you know, he would talk in Christian terms about the policy and its effect, and more or less, they're going to thank us later, that kind of attitude. They're really obnoxious people, and they would have been obnoxious in any country they went to. The sad thing about humanity is that they appear in every country, in every age. They're present at the moment, as we know, and we give them far too much oxygen. In fact, we elect them to high office. We should know better by now.
So the process of discovery and self-realisation that Harley goes through in Benang is a much larger story. And this is why, I guess, for you, it stands out as a book that's changed not only your thinking, but maybe the thinking of many others.
Yeah, this is what really good books do. They ask the reader to investigate themselves. They're not reading a pantomime. They're reading a surgical journal of how to investigate themselves, and this book does it brilliantly. You know, people talk about Dead Man's Dance, one of Kim's other books. It's a brilliant book, but I read Benang first, and because it came out first, and so that incisive challenge to the reader's psyche was was huge. And it just, amongst all the thousands and thousands of books that I've read, it stands out to me.
Well, both those books have won the Miles Franklin Award. Benang From the Heart won in 2000, sharing the award with Thea Astley for Drylands. So, and at that time, Kim Scott was the first Indigenous Australian author to win the Miles Franklin. So,
and to be paired with Thea Astley, who was a magnificent writer and a really great person, that's an honour to them both.
Okay, to another book that you'd like to suggest.
Yeah, I'd recommend Every Secret Thing by Maureen Moncara, mainly because so few people have read it and many more people need to read it. I read it as a manuscript, and it was in a literary competition, and it stood head and shoulders above every other book in that competition, because the writing's so good, but also it's so incisive and scandalous. You know, people can be scandalised by Marie's books because they call spades shovels, and they call dirt mud. You know, this is a really, really strong book. And, you know, the writer isn't the hero of the book. That's the great thing about Marie, is that she's not the hero of any of her books. She's the sort of accident within the book. I think she's a great writer. I think there's better books to come from her. And I really look forward to Australians reading Maureen Moncara when she's 65. I think the way her mind is expanding, like the cosmos, is going to frighten the pants off people.
That is a great prospect. She's also famously very funny.
Yeah, she's a funny person. Who's got incredible wit And her books consequently have incredible wit, you know, startling observations, shocking observations. You know, I think Catholics should read this with some caution. But she's not cruel. She's not a cruel person. And that also shows in the book, because she's showing a side of Black Australia which is not going to appeal to all Black Australians either. She's unafraid. She's unafraid. And that's why, you know, people who are unafraid get themselves into a lot of trouble with people who are more afraid. But the challenge of the fearless is to call out the world for what it is. And she does that. And, you know, I love her books because of it. Another book to sit beside Maureen Moncaro's is Melissa Lukashenko's Mullumbimby. And this book was about Aboriginal community. And as soon as I read it, I had the trepidation that this community wasn't going to be all noble savage at all. Most of the time was just going to be savage. And that's what I loved about it, because I could see community. I understood how real it was. And I was thinking, once again, my fellow Australians are going to open this book and are going to be so surprised by what they read about how the Aboriginal community actually works, what they think, what they're trying to do, and how riotous the process becomes. So this was a grand book, and it's not even Melissa's best book, but it's one that stood out to me. When it arrived, I don't think there'd been anything like it written before. Alexis Wright in Carpentaria talks about the same thing in a different way. Alexis is a magnificent writer. She writes like a playwright, sets up scenes, images that are bold and startling, and had some of the same themes as Melissa's, but Melissa's was written in a very rollicking fashion. And so it was an important book at an important time for me. And I think this is the same for any reader. Some books ring like a bell because of what you are going through at the time that you're reading the book. And so those two things can be paired. It may not mean that the book is the best book you've ever read, but you'll never, ever forget it.
So there you go. Bruce Pascoe, writer, farmer, academic. His selections are Benang from the Heart, which is a 1999 novel by Kim Scott, which shared the Miles Franklin Award in the year 2000 with the late Thea Astley's Drylands. He also nominated Marie Moncara's Every Secret Thing and Melissa Lukashenko's Mullumbimby.
Well, great to hear from Bruce Pascoe, especially as it's NAIDOC week. And hopefully he's got you thinking about your best Australian books of all time, so you'll be ready when voting opens on Monday, the 31st of August.
That's it for this edition of The Bookshelf. We'll be back with more new books next time. I'm Cassie McCullough.
I'm Kate Evans. Join us again, won't you?
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.